Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The NASDAQ jumped 21% last quarter, its best quarter since late 2001. Database company Oracle keeps upping the ante to take over software giant PeopleSoft. Apple Computers racing ahead with its 99 cents a song iTunes music store. Internet traffic still growing 100% a year. Tonight on Point, the tech stock surge. Red hot or bubble about to burst? But we begin in Bethlehem, where church bells rang and sirens sounded as Israeli troops pulled out of the biblical West Bank town. The withdrawal follows the pullback of Israeli forces last Sunday from part of the northern Gaza Strip, and it reflects early tentative steps along the Middle East roadmap to create peace and establish a Palestinian state. Matt Rees is Jerusalem bureau chief for Time magazine. I asked him if Bethlehem is now entirely under the control of Palestinians.
More or less. There's a little bit of Bethlehem around what's called Rachel's Tomb, which even under the Oslo Accords was left for the Israelis. But other than that, yes, the Israelis have pulled out even from just the edges of the city in some cases. Essentially now they're not going to do any of the pursuit operations that they used to do, coming in large numbers and rounding up large numbers of Palestinians. So that's not going to be going on anymore. It now falls to the Palestinian Authority to do that.
Does it also mean that it's going to be easier now for Palestinians in Bethlehem to move around the West Bank and even to go up that road towards Jerusalem, which after all is only a few miles away?
It's not going to be easier for them to actually get out of town. That's one of their complaints, in fact. One of the things that the Palestinian Authority is pressing for is for the Israelis to take away the roadblocks on what's called the Wadi Nar Road, which connects Bethlehem with Ramallah. The Israelis are not saying that they're going to do that just yet, but if they do, that will make a real difference to Palestinians' freedom of movement. Jerusalem is another matter. They're going to have to show that they're ready to arrest the militants of Hamas, etc., over the coming 2 to 3 weeks before the Israelis are going to really ease up on that.
Matt, what's the situation around the Church of the Nativity? A lot of people will remember the very tense scenes there just over a year ago. Any Israeli troops now around that church?
No, the Israeli troops are well away from there. What's actually happened now is that just on the corner opposite that church is where the Bethlehem Central Police Station is. And up until now, during the course of the Intifada, the door has been closed and the Palestinian policemen who were there were in plain clothes because the Israeli jeep or tank could come by at any moment and they could be rounded up or shot. Today, the door was open and there were Palestinian policemen lounging around, not apparently doing very much, but at least they had the uniforms on.
For the people, then, of Bethlehem, is life going to be at least a little easier now?
Yes, it is somewhat easier because they don't have that extreme tension of having Israeli soldiers and Israeli tanks roaming around. They know at least if they don't go to the edge of town, then they're not going to face that kind of situation. And it has been extremely unpredictable for them. And so even those who adopted a fairly pessimistic view, and many did when I was in Bethlehem today, they at least have to acknowledge, well, that's better.
There's been the pullout from most of the Gaza Strip. There's now been this pullout today from Bethlehem. That's two important ingredients in what this roadmap to peace involves. What comes next?
Well, over the next 2 to 3 weeks, the Israelis say they want to see the Palestinians arresting Hamas or Fatah gunmen who are, as the Israelis call them, ticking bombs, planning or in the act of carrying out some kind of operation against Israelis. If they can do that, then there will be more cities, probably Ramallah or Hebron would be the next one to go, that would be handed back to the security control of the Palestinians. From the Israeli side now, of course, there's this issue of the settlements. I don't think they're really going to take any further action until they are quite sure that the Palestinians are following through on the security aspect. What the Israelis have done with the settlement so far is they have been pulling their people out of some of these so-called illegal outposts, which in many cases are just a caravan or two on a hilltop. But it's going to be quite a time before we see anything approaching an evacuation of an existing established settlement.
I have seen reports just over the last few days, I don't know if you can confirm them, Matt, to the effect that for every illegal outpost that has been dismantled, another one has sprung up somewhere else.
Well, at least one. It's in fact a little bit farcical the way in which it's done. I don't think the Israeli army has quite figured out how to go to these hilltops where large crowds will have gathered to protect the one or two caravans. They drag all those people away, but not very far, and then they remove the caravans. And usually the settlers can take back a caravan there that night, or they can just go to the next hill where there are no soldiers. So it's a little bit farcical, and it's the kind of situation where people here who are living inside Israel and consider themselves against the whole settlement project don't quite understand why it is that the law is not really applied to the settlers as they see it. That a lot of Israelis believe that that's the case. It's not applied to the settlers. But if the Palestinians deliver, then Prime Minister Sharon is actually going to have to remedy that situation and really do something about those outposts to begin with, and then, before too long, some of the established settlements.
Let me ask you about the situation regarding the Palestinian Prime Minister, Mahmoud Abbas, or Abu Mazen. A lot of people felt when he was appointed that he had very little political legitimacy, that he'd been put there under pressure very much from the Americans. If Palestinians begin to see the Israeli army withdrawing first from Gaza, now from Bethlehem, perhaps from other places in the weeks to come, does that help bolster his political position?
It certainly does, but his problem right now is how does he deal with Yasser Arafat? Because Arafat gave up almost all of his powers, supposedly, to Prime Minister Abbas, but then behind the scenes rather clawed them back. Abbas only has control of a very small proportion of the Palestinian security forces. The much larger security forces in Bethlehem that respond to the orders of Arafat are the ones who are going to be key to keeping this ceasefire and to arresting people who are about to break it. Now, the fact that they have started to cooperate with the ceasefire and with Abbas's orders, essentially, is a sign that Arafat is trying to assert his importance in the whole process here and to make the Israelis and the Americans realize they have to deal with him in some form. Otherwise, nothing is going to get done and ceasefires are not going to be held and so on. So it could signal something of a reemergence of Arafat as a power, even if it's only signaled behind the scenes to the Israelis and the Americans while Prime Minister Abbas takes the front role, if you like.
Matt Rees, thanks very much indeed for talking to us.
Thank you, Roman.
Matt Rees is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for Time. He spoke with us from Jerusalem. Many people watched with horror as their retirement plans and rainy day savings disappeared when technology stocks fizzled. More than 1,000 telecom companies have filed for bankruptcy since 2000. Initial public offerings are at a 28-year low, and venture capitalists are dubious of any high-flying technology pitch. Yet the Nasdaq keeps rising. eBay sold $15 billion worth of goods last year. Microsoft's Xbox Live network has 550,000 subscribers, and it seems that nearly everybody has a digital camera. But did you even notice that technology stocks are soaring? Do you care? Are you itching to get back into the market, or are you still smarting from when the last bubble burst? Do you think that technology firms, many of which are now making real profits, are worthy of your retirement plans and your children's college funds? Or have you sworn off high-tech stocks for the long term? Join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Lenox, Massachusetts, is Brett Swanson, executive editor of the Gilder Technology Report. He celebrated the resurgence of the Nasdaq in a Wall Street Journal editorial that appeared yesterday, titled "The Tech Comeback is Real." Brett Swanson, thanks very much for joining us on the show tonight. Also with us from New Haven, Connecticut, Robert Schiller, Professor of Economics at Yale University and author of Irrational Exuberance and The New Financial Order, Risk in the 21st Century. Professor Schiller, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Now, Brett Swanson, you like what you see. Justify your enthusiasm for us.
I think there are some important factors that point to a possible continuation of what we've seen over the last couple of months in technology. First of all, there are a few macroeconomic factors that are pointing in the right direction. On May 21st, Congress passed a major tax cuts in capital gains, dividends, personal income, new depreciation rules. And by June 2nd, equities were already up $750 billion. They're now up some $1 trillion since the tax cut. I think demolishing the idea that tax cuts, quote, cost any money. And this is not taking into account future GDP growth effects. The second macro factor is monetary policy. The dollar, I think, has now returned to normal, stable levels since its ultra-strong days of the late 90s and early 2000s. An ultra-strong dollar, or in other words, a scarce dollar, kills companies and even countries with debt. So therefore, the telecom companies that were building a new worldwide infrastructure, large with lots of leverage, got killed. Countries from Russia to Argentina to Turkey, anyone with debt denominated in dollars got killed. Now the new stable lower dollar is making leverage and risk-taking more possible. The third policy obstacle that I think has been mitigated somewhat is we're seeing some relief on broadband deregulation from the Federal Communications Commission, and we're seeing some faster deployment of broadband connections to homes and businesses, and we're sort of passing the 20 million mark in the number of connections to homes.
So let me just see if I get this right. I mean, to put it at its simplest, are you saying that you believe over the coming months more people, both individuals and corporate customers, are going to be buying hardware and software, information technology products, and that is going to mean more profits and better returns for investors?
I think that's largely true. I think besides the policy factors I mentioned, you see some companies now taking risks with new applications out there. Just in the last 10 days or so, Microsoft and Apple announced that they would upgrade their popular instant messaging applications to now do video and voice. You mentioned digital cameras. There are new cheap video camera technologies that are coming about. And as these things become popular on the Internet, I think we're going to see new demand for high-speed internet, more applications, and that requires a new, build-out of the internet, costing some tens of billions or even hundreds of billion dollars in new investment.
Okay, let me just turn to Robert Schiller then at this point. Professor Schiller, does this sound rational to you or irrational?
Well, let me say first, I am excited by the technology advances that we're seeing these days. I agree that progress is continuing and the world is getting better. But I think that the biggest criticism I would make of what Brett Swanson has said is the link between this technology and investments in technology stocks. As a matter of fact, it is very hard to predict investment performance. And it could go either way. And moreover, prices appear quite high. I think the stock market is vulnerable, even though Brett Swanson is absolutely right that there are exciting things going on in technology.
Okay. Stay with us, both of you. We're going to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the surge in technology stocks and what might lie behind it. Are you ready to invest in NASDAQ companies once again? Is this the second coming of the Internet, or is it the second coming of irrational exuberance? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back in just a couple of minutes. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're taking stock of the stock market. The Nasdaq is jumping. Are you ready to jump back in? Whom do you listen to for financial advice? The Wall Street Journal? Your financial advisor? Your neighbour? Or is your money safest under the mattress? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Brett Swanson, executive editor of the Gilder Report and a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, a public policy think tank in Seattle, and with Robert Shiller, professor of economics at Yale University and author of Irrational Exuberance. Professor Shiller, we were discussing what is actually going on out there in the high technology sector, but to what extent do you believe that investors make their decisions based on what's actually happening, and to what extent do they make their decisions based on hunch?
Well, of course, the answer is for most investors, it's based on hunch and based on casual hearsay evidence and by a sense of the market, a sort of intuitive sense of the market. What's happened recently in the first quarter, earnings growth was quite substantial, and particularly tech stocks' earnings growth. And that's the main reason for what we've seen in the market. When this information came out, people got very excited about that. And that's psychology, but it's driven by earnings.
Is it true, then, that prices go up when people buy a stock, and people buy a stock when prices go up? It just feeds on itself.
Yeah, well, this is something that I talked about in my book. I think feedback of this sort is an essential element in all markets at some time or another. It was very strong in the 90s that people were just getting increasingly excited. And this little blip that we've just seen since March, you know, is not that big compared to the 90s. The late 90s was the biggest stock market event since 1929. And we've got a little up blip. Let's not get too excited about it.
Well, but 20% over 3 months is a lot better than in the recent past.
Yeah, although from a low base.
Sure.
We've still, the S&P 500, if you correct for inflation, is down about 40% from the peak.
So you're saying to people, remain cautious, are you?
People should diversify. And I think people should be very wary of plunging in, especially to tech stocks, which have a lot of downside potential. Remember, the price earnings ratio on the NASDAQ index right now is infinite. There are no earnings on the overall NASDAQ stocks. It can't be a good, solid, safe investment strategy to go plunging in. I'm not against holding some of these stocks, but we should definitely diversify and hold cash and bonds and real estate and other investments.
Brett Swanson, you were talking about all the various macroeconomic indicators which you say are looking pretty positive at the moment. You didn't mention unemployment because that's not looking positive at all, is it?
No, there's been, in fact, lots of talk in recent days that productivity, largely, I might say, fueled by a lot of the technologies that we saw in the 90s, is actually maybe holding down employment because we can do more with fewer people. So surely we'd all like to see more people working. But unemployment, I think, is really a lagging indicator. And I think you'll see, whereas the stock market often is the best leading indicator. So the stock market could go up, real economic growth could come back, and employment could come back even further down the road.
But if a company isn't prepared to take on extra workers because it faces the future with confidence, is it likely to spend money on new information technology products?
Well, if it thinks that those technology products can better leverage its current workforce and yield better returns, then it will. There's always a trade-off between labor and capital, and what you've just seen, I think, with the tax cuts is that capital is much less expensive now. And so I hope that it will encourage companies to make new investments.
I look at this as a semi-outsider, although, of course, economies in Europe are very much affected by what happens on this side of the Atlantic. But even I noticed that the Federal Reserve cut interest rates again last week down to 1%. They're worried about something. Shouldn't I be worried as well?
I don't think that clearly I think that the Fed is worried about deflation about 6 years too late. You had the massive strengthening of the dollar in the late 90s. Like I said, a scarcity of the dollar. It largely now has come down. You've seen it fall against the euro, against other currencies. You've seen commodity prices rise. I think deflation is largely over just when they're starting to worry about it. And that's another, just like unemployment, the CPI and other things are lagging indicators. So I think we're on the right track.
Robert Shiller, you have studied the way in which investors behave, the psychology of the investor. Do you believe that those people who were burnt last time round by the dot bust are less likely now to go back in because of that experience?
Well, I think that the idea that the stock market is the best investment for long-term holders has weakened substantially. The great enthusiasm for stocks has to some extent been replaced by an enthusiasm for housing and for government bonds, and we've seen big increases in prices in those sectors as well. On the other hand, other aspects, it's never a clear, it's never easy to understand human psychology, and by some other measures, confidence in the market really hasn't changed that much. I think people are less emotionally into the market. They're still expecting it to go up a lot, the knee-jerk response, but I don't think that they have the same emotional commitment to it. And I think the market is rather vulnerable. And even though, I think that the employment situation is also vulnerable, and there's a risk of a drop in confidence. Confidence is still not back up to high levels. And I think the whole situation is vulnerable right now.
Okay, let's talk to a caller now. Remember, you can join our conversation. Just call in to 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Terence is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Terence, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're most welcome. Are you plunging back in?
I am, but two quick points I want to make, and I'd love to get a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
One is, I think the bubble's beside the point. Although the NASDAQ's gone up a little bit more than the S&P, as was mentioned, I think it's come up from fairly low levels. I think the issue is really technology is transforming our country and our economy and the world, but it may not be the companies that supply the technology that make their profits or rents. It may be those companies that use the technology. The automakers, even eBay to an extent, is not so much a technology innovator as a technology deployer in terms of selling on the Internet. So I would say that I think that I'm optimistic that technology will keep transforming the economy, and therefore I'm optimistic about the market in general and not especially focused on the NASDAQ.
Before I get Brett Swanson to respond to that, Terence, let me ask you this. Where do you get your information from? On what kind of information do you make your decisions?
That's a great question. I get my information mostly from business periodicals, but also, truthfully, more on an intuitive basis based on my user of certain products or my experience with certain products and seeing how things are done. So, for example, if I'm on a website and I'm participating in eBay auction and I really like some feature of the auction site, I'll think, geez, maybe that's a stock I want to own. So sort of as the experience as a customer is probably a big one for me.
Okay, thanks. Brett Swanson, do you think Terence is right in what he says?
I think certainly that technology does have all sorts of spillover effects into all parts of the economy, and it can spill over to other nations as well. That's why it's so powerful. Certainly there will be technology companies that do better than others in the stock market, and the companies out of what we call technology that use technology the most effectively will more than likely lead their sectors. So he's right. He's right in that regard.
Isn't it, though, also true that a large number of corporations at the moment at least have the kind of IT capability that they require? They can probably carry on quite well for the next 2 to 3 years with what they've got?
Well, I don't know. That's a question. I don't think right now, for instance, that we have the type of network, optical network, in place that is needed to actually consummate the video, what I call the video-friendly net. So if you want very easy-to-use video conferencing, very easy-to-use educational videos and so forth, most companies, I don't think, can do that today.
Let me now welcome Aaron Task to our program. Aaron Task, senior writer at thestreet.com, joins us from San Francisco. Aaron Task, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roman.
Now, what do you make of this? Are you an enthusiast?
I'd have to come down on the side with Professor Shiller. I think there has been a lot of enthusiasm generated for stocks, and especially tech stocks lately, that's based more just on the market momentum than really on any big improvement in fundamentals.
That means that you are not convinced that the kind of objective indicators that Brett Swanson was talking about a few minutes ago necessarily mean that it's time to plunge back in?
I definitely don't think it's time to plunge back in, and I don't think that some of the things he talked about really are going to translate into big profits for companies. I wonder who is going to lay additional fiber optic cable when there's already millions of miles of cable that's out there that's not being used. When he's talking about another rollout of the Internet, I'm not sure, you know, where that money for that is going to come from and if it's necessary at this point.
Brett Swanson?
Aaron is right that there is plenty of fiber in the ground, at least on the intercity routes, on the long-haul routes, as we call them. But as far as fiber going to businesses and homes and the equipment, the technologies that are needed to, quote, light that fiber and provide the bandwidth over that fiber are not in place largely. So he's right that in the long haul that's there, we probably don't need any more fiber to homes and businesses, and the equipment that makes it go, we do need much more of that.
Robert Shiller, let me come back to you. Our caller was just talking a moment ago about getting his information partly from specialist journals, but also partly from what he called intuition. Is that typical?
I think intuition is a powerful force in the market. People have a sense of momentum, and people may tell them, well, it's approximately a random walk, but they won't believe it.
Isn't that just another way of saying they're following the herd?
There's a tendency for excitement to develop, and that people see other people making money and they get drawn in and they get excited. And it's a little bit like gambling. It can be fun at times as long as it's going up. And once it goes down, it has the reverse effect. People get fed up with it and they turn off the TV set, the business channel, and stop reading the business magazines.
It's pretty hard, isn't it? I mean, if my neighbor tells me he's made himself $10,000 in a month by having invested in a particular stock, I'm going to be mighty tempted to do the same.
Although there aren't so many, maybe a few people since March, but it hasn't really invaded our culture. And I don't think it will invade our culture for a long time, the way it did in the 90s.
You don't think that that kind of behavior is going to repeat itself?
I mean, it's always there to some extent. There's always people herding on. But that's part of the reason why there was such a reaction to the earnings increase in the stock market in the last few months. But just trying to put things in a big global perspective, we're not back to the 90s, and I don't see it happening again.
Steve is on the line from Norton, Massachusetts. Steve, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. Okay, well, what do you make of all this?
Well, I've been in high-tech sales myself, and I was pushed out of the high-tech business when I got when our business fell apart back in 2001, so I've experienced it from that side, and just now finding myself way back into the market. But listening to both of these gentlemen, what I find is I think that there are more variables to the equation than you can really account for at this point in time. I mean, I think both sides are pretty much on target with what their beliefs are. I think the answer is somewhere in the middle. If you look back at the end of 99, I think the millennium really created a bubble for us. A lot of people invested in enterprise systems and upgrades and all the way down to their shop floor. They just pulled out the plugs and they invested.
But
then the bottom fell out.
And that sounds to me as if what you draw from that is that people should be very careful.
Well, yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic because I think what's happened is that when the millennium came and everybody had invested all this money, I mean, they basically pulled out the stops on their capital budgets, spent a lot of money on improvements to the organizations and really didn't see anything. And it's like a big dead time in the system. I think we're now starting to see the productivity of the improvements from all of that investment, but it took us 3 years to get there.
Okay.
Now, the problem with this, the equipment that they bought 3-4 years ago is now old, and they're going to have to replace some of that stuff. So some of the market should be coming back.
Steve, thanks for your call. Aaron Task, a few years back, when people were still very excited about all of this, they read avidly what all of the experts, the analysts, the pundits were telling them. Do those people now take more care? Are they now more accurate? Are they more cautious than they were 3-4 years ago?
I think they're less likely to believe at face value the comments they hear someone, a quote-unquote market guru, say on television or read about in the paper. I think they are very heavily influenced, though, by, you know, broad market activity. My sense, though, is that most individuals in this country never really got out of the market in a major way. They saw their portfolios decline and they sort of tuned out, which is different than getting out of the market altogether. So I think people, if, you know, there's the stories of people who don't read their statements. I think if people haven't read their statements, they might want to take a look and they might be pleasantly surprised.
Well, there came a time when it was just too depressing for words to read those statements.
Absolutely. But, you know, now is the time to take a look, and you might see a stock that you had that went to $2 is now at $8, and maybe you should think about taking some profits in that.
But Robert Shiller, one of the things that happened in the 90s, if I'm not mistaken, was that a lot of people who hadn't been in the markets got into the markets because all around them they heard people saying that this was the way to make good money. Are those people still in? Are they going to be joined by yet more people who have not so far dipped their toe into this water?
Well, I think people who just got in are maybe more emotionally distressed than others. That happened a lot in Europe, where a lot of people were just getting excited, you know, with in consonant with the U.S. boom, and now they're kind of fed up.
It does help a market, though, doesn't it, if new people come in, create a bit more buying frenzy?
Well, you call it help a market. I don't think it's a good thing for the stock market to get overpriced, and that's what happened. And then so it has to come back down, and it creates all of this unevenness. The real event, and really the world, the advanced countries of the world in the last 5 years, has been this stock market boom and crash, and it's affected all of our lives. It's created a surge in employment at the beginning of this millennium, and now all this overcapacity and all this chaos and confusion that's brought the economy down. And so it hasn't been a good thing at all.
Okay, Brett Swanson, Robert Shiller, Aaron Task, stay with us if you would. We're going to take a short break. We're discussing NASDAQ's high-flying quarter and whether you're ready to invest in technology stocks again. Are you itching to get back in, or are you still smarting from the last bubble? It's not an easy decision to make. Do you think that technology firms, now many of them with real revenues, real profits, are worthy of your retirement plan, your children's college funds? You can join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the tech comeback. The NASDAQ has climbed 21% in the last quarter. Did you even notice? Do you care? What do you think could be behind the surge? Are you ready to dive back into the murky waters of technology stocks? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Brett Swanson, executive editor of the Gilder Report and a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, a public policy think tank in Seattle. Robert Shiller, professor of economics at Yale University and author of Irrational Exuberance, is also with us tonight, as is Aaron Task, senior writer for The Street. Sarah is calling us from Derry in New Hampshire. Sarah, hi.
Hi. I'm calling in with a comment that I think hasn't been quite covered yet, and that's about the millennial generation, which estimates are of there are people born after 1979, and they're the second largest generation in U.S. history, and they range between 54 million and 76 million strong, depending on your numbers. And they're very technology inclined. And being a part of that generation myself, I see a lot of long-term growth as they become owners and managers of businesses in buying technology and creating it and implementing it. They're very savvy about technology and see it as an integral part of both the workplace and their private lives. So I have confidence that there will be a lot of long-term slow growth, but I don't expect, as an investor, I don't expect any miracles to happen.
Okay, Sarah, thanks. Robert Schiller, is there a demographic element in all of this?
Well, what I got most from what Sarah said was that there's a sense of the new technology that the young people today have and that they are going to run with it, and I believe they will. I think we have to put this in perspective as an investor, though, and recall that at any point in the last century or two centuries, there has been some technology, and there were young people then who were running with it. So when they invented the airplane, when they invented the automobile, and any of these things, there was exciting things happening. We have to compare now with these other periods, which is very hard to do. The 20th century brought us from horse and buggy days into jet airplanes and computers and all that. So there's been a lot of exciting technical progress in the past, and we just have to be thankful that we have some now going forward so that we can expect the same sort of economic growth that we've seen over the last 100 years.
Aaron Tass, can I just introduce one other element into this discussion, and that is the whole experience of the last couple of years of corporate malfeasance and the lack of transparency. There are new regulations in place now. New legislation was introduced. Does that make a difference? Do you think, should it make a difference to investor confidence?
I think it makes a small difference to investor confidence, but I think, frankly, because of the fact that none of the executives from Enron or WorldCom or some of the other, you know, biggest wrongdoers have been in prison, a lot of investors out there still believe that the game is rigged and there's no real punishment, certainly no punishment to fit the crime, and they're still wary about the numbers that they're seeing from Wall Street firms. And you know, we recently had a huge earnings restatement from Freddie Mac, and I think that that overhang is still with us. And if I could just make a quick point about the caller's point about demographics, it's a great point, but the counterbalance is when baby boomers, which are the biggest population age group in the country, start to retire, that's going to have a corresponding negative effect on the stock market. So it cuts both ways when you talk about demographics.
And Brett Swanson, let me bring you in here. If we're talking specifically about high-tech companies, isn't it corporate customers who really decide whether or not these firms are going to do well rather than the individuals buying a new PC?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly a big factor. I think both are important, and I don't know the exact breakdown of where they sell. But I think people more and more are doing more and more things from their home, things that they wouldn't used to. I mean, telecommuting obviously happens more and more every day, and we're getting more and more powerful machines in our home. So both are important.
Okay, thanks for that. Let me just remind you, you can join our conversation. We're talking about whether the time has come to dip our toes back into the high-tech waters. The NASDAQ is going up. Is it time to start buying again? Join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Schiller, talking about the psychology of investors, people look at what their neighbors are doing, people listen to what they hear people saying. Do you think that actually matters more when they come to decide what to do with their savings than what they read in the specialist journals, what they hear on the specialist channels?
Well, I think that actually over the history of the stock market, the main force that's been driving it is psychology. I mean, in some sense, that's psychological overreaction to earnings. But it's just also just independent psychology where people when I say psychology, I don't mean manic depressive psychosis. I mean that we listen to each other. Our attention is captured. The media plays a role in capturing our attention to certain theories. So in the 1990s, the theory was that this internet revolution was going to totally change our lives.
I remember people telling me it was going to change the way in which economies operated. All the old rules were going to be torn up, people said.
But actually, it will change our lives gradually and imperceptibly over decades. And yes, it's very important. but it doesn't warrant the huge explosion in stock prices that we saw then. And see, it's ultimately, it is psychology. It's a lot of human emotions go behind a purchase decision. People have to decide to buy stocks at high price earnings ratio, and all sorts of things run through their mind. For example, the envy of their neighbor who made so much money, or just the stimulation that you get from the excitement of playing the game, or the idea that you want to be part of the in crowd who are doing these things. I mean, I'm not saying any one of those things is so important, but overall there's a picture of the emotional demand for stock that's developed by a whole ambiance and by a view of the world at a particular time.
Aaron Task, it's pretty tough though, isn't it? I mean, we all of us want to save for our old age. We want to make sure that our kids get a decent education. Interest rates are at very, very low levels. Not much point just keeping the cash in the bank. People have to make decisions.
It's true, and absolutely. And I think part of the problem is that we became accustomed to 20% plus returns from the stock market in the late 1990s, and that is a historical anomaly, and what people have to get themselves more accustomed to is maybe 5 to 7% being a pretty good year. And I think it's all about adjusting expectations, and at this point, I still think people perceive the stock market as a place where you can make a quick 15 to 20% on a regular basis, and that's just not the case historically.
Ed is on the line from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Ed, hi.
Hi. And my concern is that stocks are more expensive than they seem to be, especially on the NASDAQ, considering stock options. It seems that a company that sells for a PE of 40 could easily have a PE of 80, and should the stock do well, immediately those stock options will be exercised.
So what conclusion, then, do you draw from that?
That there is limited upside potential. The moment the stocks will do better, the people, the insiders, will sell and will bring the stock back down.
Ed, thanks. Brett Swanson, do you think that's right?
Well, I think that certainly, options and the accounting affect the accounting number that comes out when you do a PE or any other sort of ratio, but there's far too much of a focus, I think, on so-called gap accounting, using other, I think, more economically fundamental ways of doing things. You can get different results. So enshrining gap accounting into whether we buy or sell stocks, I don't think, it certainly has not proved in the past to be a real important factor. And getting back to the point on psychology, economies are full of psychologies. It's very true. But I think far more important than consumer confidence or even investor confidence is entrepreneurial confidence, both at small companies and people making entrepreneurial decisions at big companies. That is that's the leading indicator. That is what in turn drives, I think, investment decisions.
Peter's on the line from Warwick, Rhode Island. Peter, hi. Oh, I don't think Peter is on the line from Warwick. Let me go back to Robert Shiller for a second, because we've just been talking about some fairly technical considerations about how to judge the value of a stock, whether it's overvalued or undervalued. But you were suggesting earlier that that's not really how most people make their decisions.
No, I think people don't look at the numbers very often. They look at the stories. But the numbers are troubling. And in responding to Ed's question, the Standard & Poor's, which computes the S&P 500, has come up with a new concept of earnings that corrects for some of these things like options. And according to S&P, the price-earnings ratio on the S&P 500 is currently at 41 with core earnings, as they define it, rather than 32. Which is with reported earnings. 41 is a very high number for the market. I think he's right that these...
Forgive me, what do those numbers actually represent? What are they measuring here?
Yeah, when you have a price-earnings ratio of 40, say, round it, that means that earnings are, 2.5% of the value of the stock. In other words, if you could get all those earnings, it would take you 40 years to make back your investment. And historically, it's been more like 15 years. So it's just a very high number, and that's the thing that gets lost in this current discussion. Part of what happened in the irrational exuberance period of the 90s is that we just got accustomed to higher price-earnings ratios, and now it's just a part of the background that we're not shocked by anymore.
I think we can now go and talk to Peter in Warwick, Rhode Island. Peter, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I find it quite interesting. I would also appreciate the appreciation in the values in the stock market. However, I believe ultimately it would have to be justified by an improved revenue model, as well as which then would lead to improved earnings in order to justify the higher values. Now, specifically, many of the companies on the stock market are selling equipment which has to be paid for, and a significant portion of that ends up in, let's say, telecom services. Now, the question I have is, what suggestions would there be for improved revenue models, which essentially would increase the revenues for service companies? In other words, to which degree are actually telephone or telecom services generating higher revenues?
Okay, thanks for that. Brett Swanson, do you want to try and respond to that?
Well, I think I know what he's saying. You know, those are sort of technical matters, and I think, you know, without going to, I'm not going to get too deep into it because I'm not an accounting expert, but I think the focus on accounting coming out of the last 3 years is one of the, certainly we all want people to be honest and not commit fraud, that's, you know, of course, but the focus on the belief that there are certain people that know how to do the accounting right, and if we get the accounting right, everything will sort of fall into place, is I think erroneous, and it doesn't measure the real state of the economy.
Aaron Task, what's your take on this?
I would agree with Brett on that. I think there's been a lot of focus on accounting issues because of all the wrongdoing that's gone on, but in the 1990s, we weren't so focused on accounting because the economy was booming and everything was good and everyone was happy, so we didn't care about the small details. And I think maybe the fact that people are still so concerned about those details reflects the fact that we're still in a very difficult period.
Let me just get a last thought from you, Robert Shiller, before we wrap up this conversation. Your sense, I take it, is that people are less likely now to make the kind of mistakes that they made 10, 8 years ago this time round?
Yeah, I think that a resurgence of the bubble of the 90s is unlikely. That was a whole social phenomenon that affected many things. We just mentioned accounting. Well, in a bubble period, people do become lax. They don't care about the numbers. And I think another thing that happened in the 90s was, to some extent, there was a decline in integrity of the accounting profession and of some members of the business profession. Fortunately, it was quite limited. You know, we haven't seen that many indictments as a fraction of the whole thing.
Okay, we'll wrap it up there. I'm grateful to all of you. Brett Swanson from the Guild of Technology Report, Robert Shiller, Professor of Economics at Yale University, Aaron Task in San Francisco, Senior Writer at TheStreet.com. Thank you all very much for being with us. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.